You're listening to the Drawing the Ideal Self podcast for November 2023. In today's episode of the podcast, I'm going to read a chapter from Invitation to Personal Construct Psychology by Butt and Burr. This chapter is about people learning from their mistakes and why they may not learn from them. The chapter is called Why Don't They Ever Learn? One of the most significant features of human beings, which distinguish us from other animals, is our remarkable capacity for learning and adaptation. We are capable of learning the most complex skills, even the relatively mundane activities of using a typewriter or following a knitting pattern are remarkable feats of coordination of hand, eye, and thought. The nature of much of our learning is by trial and error and by observation. We learn both by observing the effects of our own behaviour, feedback, and by observing what other people do, modelling. Our learning capacity, our flexibility and adaptability have been held to be the most important factors in our rise to supremacy. But if we are so good at learning from our mistakes, how do we account for those individuals who just never seem to learn? If we learn by adopting those behaviours which reward us, reinforcement, and by avoiding those which are noxious to us, negative reinforcement, why is it that some criminals repeatedly return to prison? Can't they learn to behave in a socially acceptable way? This is not only a problem in the adult world. Before corporal punishment in schools was made illegal, how many teachers were heard to say, "It's always the same few who come back for a caning. What is the matter with them? Can't they learn?" In the same way, some people never seem to have learned the way to get on with others. Their social interactions are fraught with embarrassment, because they don't seem to have caught on to the unspoken rules that one must follow in order even to engage another person in a simple conversation. Such deficits in social skills have been the focus of much interest for psychologists in recent years. And then there is the unfortunate individual whose learning ability seems absent when it comes to emotional relationships. One unhappy love affair follows another, and the same problems arise each time, becoming depressingly familiar. In fact, all of us, if we are honest, can look at ourselves and find some problematic area of our social relations which the benefit of experience has not helped to change. Why don't we ever learn? The kinds of answers that are on offer to these questions range from common sense through learning deficits to personality, and they are all fraught with problems. In the case of the persistent offender, whether adult or child, it seems self-evident simply from the point of view of common sense that punishment should, and therefore in most cases probably does, work. After all, we put ourselves in their shoes, so we think, and consider that the threat of imprisonment will be more than enough to make us stop and think before committing a crime. The logic of it is so persuasive, as is the apparent legitimacy of our own personal point of view, simply because it is our own, that we are left with the conclusion that such people are not rational beings. There's something wrong with the way they think. They are just plain bad. There's something wrong with their personality. Or they have no feelings for neither themselves nor anyone else. The last explanation is often tied in with psychoanalytical concepts. For example, some hard-boiled criminals have been referred to as suffering from affectionless psychopathy, Bowlby, 1953, caused by a disrupted home life in their early years. these explanations all bring problems in their wake. The notion of human beings as predisposed to irrational thought and behaviour is a terrifying one and is not new. For example, Festinger's 1957 idea of cognitive dissonance portrays us as manufacturers of rationalisations for our own behaviour, rather than as rational decision makers. What faith can we place in our decision makers or ourselves if this is true? The other two types of explanation present problems for how we can ever improve the situation, since they are rooted in the traditional idea of personality, whether inherited genetically or formed in childhood, as stable, set, and basically unchangeable. Likewise, the individual whose love life always ends in disaster is likely to be seen as in some way emotionally inadequate, a personality deficit. And the person who is socially inept is seen as either shy, a personality term which serves both as a description and an explanation, or as having failed to learn the appropriate cues, rules, and behaviours for conversation. In the case of the latter problem, some hope of change is offered. If a person has failed to learn the correct behaviours, or has learned inappropriate ones, they can presumably be trained in the skills they lack. Such social skills training has become popular with psychologists and psychotherapists. Through the use of video recordings, role play, and subsequent feedback, clients are taught to recognise their errors and to identify appropriate behaviour, for which they are rewarded by encouragement and approval from the trainer. Social skills training can be very helpful, but for some, who are otherwise intelligent people, it does not solve their problems. Sometimes they cannot transfer their learning from the training context to real-life situations. It is often apparent that the problem for many of these people is not that they fail to recognise appropriate behaviours. They are quite as clued in this respect, as those whom we would term socially competent. The problem lies in putting this knowledge into practice. So in a variety of ways, our usual explanations for why people never seem to learn are fraught with problems themselves. Let us now look at these learning difficulties and see what light a PCP approach can shed on them. Reward and punishment at first appear to be fairly straightforward ideas, in combination with a basically hedonistic pleasure principle model of humankind. This recipe suggests, as we have already noted, that human beings will adopt behaviours that are rewarded and avoid those that are punished. Even within this behavioristic model, there are good reasons for doubting the efficacy of punishment as a shaper of human behaviour. See Skinner, 1974. But the real problem is even more fundamental. Just what is a reward? What is a punishment? We should not have to inquire of many people before it became apparent that what is rewarding for one person is not so for another. Some strive for money, others for status or power. Some find their rewards in sex or friendship. For yet others, it is food and drink. In the end, the only possible and pragmatically useless definition of a reward is that which a person finds rewarding. The same is true of punishment. For some, life on the proverbial desert island would be purgatory. For others, heaven. The child who receives a caning on the behind for a misdemeanour may see it as the price you pay for popularity, proof of teachers' aggressive natures, or a sexual assault. In each of these cases, it is obvious that the relationship between the punishment and the subsequent behaviour is not a simple one. The point that we are making here is that events mean different things to different people, constructive alternativism. There are an infinite number of ways of construing, giving meaning to, an event, and it is dangerous to assume that our own construction, or even that adopted by many people, which is part of what we call common sense, is the right one. So in considering the effectiveness or ineffectiveness of reward and punishment, that is, why people just don't learn, we have to recognise that it is the meaning that events hold for people, not the events themselves, which is the influential factor. Having said this, it may seem that what we are saying is that if we could just identify what is rewarding or punishing for any one person, we should hold the key to changing their behaviour, like Winston Smith in 1984. But it is not as simple as this. People can only act within a framework of possible choices open to them. And by this, we do not just mean that people are limited by their circumstances. They may be disabled, poor, or uneducated. Of course, they are limited by these things in their capacity to change. But what matters is not the choices an outsider thinks are available to another person. People can change only if they themselves perceive that they have any options that make sense to them. Take, for example, a delinquent whose perspective on the world is dominated by a construct which continually asks, "Are you going to beat the system or let it beat you?" For this person, criminal behaviour may bring with it undesirable side effects, like imprisonment. But these are slight by comparison with the implications of what they perceive to be the only other choice available, being beaten by the system. So the choices we perceive to be available to us are always dependent upon the nature of our own construct system, the hue of the particular spectacles through which we have come to view the world. Looking at the problem in this way, it is obvious why notions such as learning, reward, and punishment often do not serve us well when it comes to changing our or other people's behaviour. For the individual in the above example, change cannot come about until they have found a way of looking at life which does not entail the beat the system, be beaten by it dichotomy. This may be a tall order, but at least it provides us with a more facilitative and optimistic view of human nature than those implied by either psychoanalytical or traditional personality theories. Perceived choices and the nature of an individual's construing are also central, we would argue, to any real understanding of the other kinds of problems mentioned earlier in this chapter. For the person who cannot manage an ordinary conversation, or for the one who always seems to be making the same mistakes in their relationships, PCP can offer a better understanding of the problem than learning, and a more optimistic view of the future than personality. Let's look at an example of what might be happening for a person who, in learning theory terms, has a social skills deficit. Pauline had always thought of herself as a shy person, but unlike most people, after leaving behind the awkwardness of inexperience in adolescence, her social relationships deteriorated. She could often think of nothing to say for herself, and when she did speak, which was only when she was directly addressed, it was almost inaudible. She avoided eye contact with people, which made it even more difficult to hold a relaxed conversation with her, and her whole demeanour seemed to discourage interaction. She was at first enthusiastic when social skills training was suggested to her. The first few sessions went quite well, and she was quick to understand where her deficits lay. However, when it came to putting this knowledge into practice, Pauline could make no progress. Role play sessions were aimed at rewarding her for talking more, introducing topics of conversation, and looking directly in the face of the person that she was talking to. After one or two unsuccessful attempts, she became depressed and requested that the sessions be terminated. The key to Pauline's difficulties came to light when she was encouraged to talk about the difference, as she saw it, between herself and people who were good talkers, the sort of person she was supposed to try to become. It seemed to her that the world could be divided up into people who are domineering and those who are sensitive. Domineering, sensitive, was thus a construct which flavoured her approach to all social situations. In Kellyan terms, this construct was superordinate for her because it played a very central role in how she thought about people, and because it tended to subsume other constructs, such as kind, cruel, friendly, ruthless, which also emerged as constructs characteristic of Pauline's thinking. The way she saw it, people who were confident in themselves and for whom smooth social interaction came easily gained their ability through domineering and arrogant attitude. Basically, they were unself-conscious because they had no thought for other people. Those at the other end of the construct, which included herself, were sensitive, modest, and caring. People like her, she realised, paid a price for their gentle nature, impossible social relations. But who in their right mind would want to become domineering, arrogant, and thoughtless? The choice, as she perceived it, left her better off, though unhappy, at her end of the construct. The only way out for Pauline was to find a way for her to abandon her domineering, sensitive construct in her thinking about people and replace it with an alternative that still allowed her to retain those aspects of herself she valued, sensitivity, caring, etc., but which could also accommodate good conversationalists. Kelly saw the way that we use our constructs as rather like the way scientists use theories. He used the metaphor of person as scientist as his model of human psychology. In Pauline's case, her, albeit unarticulated and implicit, theory was that people were either domineering or sensitive, and her experience in social situations seemed to her to provide plenty of evidence to support her theory. Just as scientists sometimes have such an attachment to and a belief in a particular theory that they may be less than impartial in their interpretation of the evidence without consciously intending to fudge the data, so any one of us may have invested so heavily in a theory of ourselves and other people that we always find it being confirmed, even when it is a theory, like Pauline's, that in the end makes us miserable. After all, who wouldn't sometimes rather be right than happy? It thus becomes obvious why so little progress was made when Pauline's difficulties were seen as a learning problem. Another important point to realise is that the familiarity of running in the well-worn grooves of past thought and behaviour, even when it creates problems for us, sharply contrasts with the alternatives, striking out into new and possibly dangerous uncharted territory, or even being able to comprehend there being any alternative to our current ways of doing things. In the end, we tend to do the things we have always done, in the way we have always done them, even when we do them badly. We stick with what we know. This helps us to make sense of the person's life that is a series of unsatisfactory and aborted relationships, and of the experience that many of us who see ourselves making the same mistakes within long-standing relationships. Over the years, the conflicts come to have a recognisably familiar theme. The same old issues are raised over and over, and each time we feel no better prepared to deal with them. We often feel ourselves precipitated into an unwanted replay of an old argument, or find ourselves unwillingly playing out the part we have always adopted. Why do we never learn? Surely the misery that results from such confrontation should be enough to teach us to do differently next time. Of course, what is really at the heart of this matter is not our learning ability, but our construal of ourselves and our relationships, and either our reluctance to give up what we know how to do badly for an alternative which seems to us, like Pauline, to be worse, or our inability to envisage any other way of being. It is rather like trying to imagine what might lie beyond the limits of the universe. Marion was a person for whom, subjectively, relationships were about safeguarding her own interests at the expense of those of her opponents. Although she was, she considered, otherwise happily married, over the 8 years of her marriage, the conflicts with her husband had begun to have the feel of a familiar ritual. It seemed to her that the perennial problem, which cropped up regularly at holiday time, Christmas, social occasions, etc., was whether they did what she wanted or what he wanted. Either way, she was the loser, being left with feelings of either guilt or resentment, which marred her enjoyment of whatever they did in the end. Although she could see the damage it did and wish things could be different, on each occasion she felt she had to do the only thing she knew how to do: stake her claim, defend her corner. She knew several married friends who did not seem to have this particular problem, and yet, though she desperately wished to, was at a loss to understand how it was possible to see things in any other way. The repeated punishment of marital discord, resentment and guilt did not help Marion to learn to adopt a different approach to disagreements. Her tug-of-war construal of relationships needed to be abandoned in favour of one in which the winner versus loser would not be an issue, and where compromise did not mean giving in. Just how great a task this would be for Marion depends upon how central or superordinate a place her winner versus loser construct occupies in her construct system. The more superordinate the construct, the more fundamental and therefore threatening is the necessary change, and the greater the temptation to retreat to the unhappy safety of what is known and familiar. Real personal change may never come about for some people, but the advantage of a PCP view of their problems is that it holds out to them the possibility of change and firmly identifies the agent of such change as the person, him or herself. It does not allow us to write off others or ourselves as bad characters, irrational or sick, but urges us to endeavour to gain an understanding of their construal of the world and of our own. This is the real launching pad of change. I think this is a lovely chapter emphasising the personal meaning of experiences, and the way that personal meaning makes it more or less difficult for us to change things. So if you think about people maybe that you work with, perhaps if you're working in a service where you're trying to affect change, you're trying to help people move on from experiences, the first thing that's really important to do is to look at why it is the way it is. What's their construing of the situation? And what do they make of themselves and their experiences? Until you can understand that, it's pretty difficult to help them to change. I really like the way this chapter talks about learning in a very different way. That, you know, we can assume that people will learn, but actually, unless we take their construing into account, we don't know what they're learning from an experience. What it might be doing is confirming that the theory that they had about the world and how it works is absolutely valid. And that might not be what we want. So it points back to the importance of exploring a person's construct system and knowing which constructs are more important than others. That way, we can understand what kind of things might change more or less easily. But also, if they do not choose to change, we've got a better understanding of why. I would really recommend this book, and I will probably read some other chapters from it, because I think it's a great introduction to PCP without being heavy on the theory. I'm not sure how much it costs at the moment. It's a pretty thin book compared with some big PCP tomes. But if you wanted one book to get you started with PCP that is written in a language that people speak rather than academic language, then this might be a great starting point. You could put it on your Christmas list. Okay, so I will put the details in the show notes, and I will see you again after Christmas at the end of December. I hope you have a good time, and I look forward to seeing you then. Okay, bye.